Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy, pleased to welcome you all to All Sides Weekend, and our topic today is books. And in just a few moments, we will be talking about books with Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffiths. We want to know from you what you're reading, and our panel will have a few selections to recommend as well. But first, there is some breaking news in the arts community. The Columbus Dispatch reporting this morning of a merger between CATCO, the Contemporary American Theater Company, and the Phoenix Theater. And we have on the phone the managing director of CATCO, T.J. Gerkens. Good morning, T.J. Gerkens.
Good morning, Christopher. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, thanks so much for taking the time to have me on the show.
Terrific. Now, the news this morning, as reported, says that Steven Anderson will be becoming a major player in this merger here between CATCO and the Phoenix. Steven, as far as I know, is the founder and certainly the artistic director of the Phoenix Theater for Children. So what does that mean for this new organization?
Well, it brings the strength of the two organizations together. You know, when we looked at potential mergers, we were kind of examining how do arts organizations survive in a new economy. We looked at the two companies, and I think the Phoenix and CATCO, although we talk to different audiences, have very, very similar values in what we present to our audience and how we treat our audience and how we treat literature and theater as a live form. And so it was kind of a natural fit for us. And when we brought these two groups together, we were looking at, you know, how do we handle artistic leadership? And we looked at the question of how do we form a leader who can address both the children's realm and the adult realm with mastery. And our board felt like Stephen really had a track record through the Phoenix of innovation and creativity and collaboration that we would need. So Stephen coming in, working with Jeff and with me, I think we're going to have a strong continuity of artistic vision. Most of the shows we're talking about for next season are shows that have been on our burner for a year or more, yet we're going to have more. We're going to have more depth and more breadth in our programming. So I think it's going to be a natural growth and a natural move forward.
My question also would be that, as far as I know, as a subscriber and as someone who attends CATCO's presentations, in the last 5 or 6 years at least, the artistic quality of the product has been very, very high. And you've received a number of awards, and you're doing very, very well at the box office, as far as I can tell, when I'm there. So if Jeff Nelson is behind that, my question would be, why is his role seeming to diminish in a new merger?
Well, we had basically, when you're looking at two companies that have a total number of employees of about 10, having three people up in the top leadership, we couldn't have everybody in the top leadership. Phoenix has also been doing very well, and the board really wanted to look at who they thought was the best person to take the position and lead us forward. Stephen, we think, has the same eye towards quality, the same quality standards, and frankly, the shows he's done for CATCO have been highly recognized. If you look at Love, Valor, Compassion, if you look at Taste of Sunrise. And we're really, really hoping that Jeff will stay on with us as Artistic Director Emeritus and continue to provide the leadership and continue to provide his artistry to the company.
What would you see his practical role then being as Artistic Director Emeritus? Would he be directing a number of shows per year? Would he be acting? What exactly would he be doing?
Well, our hope right now, first of all, that's all still in negotiations.
Right.
But our hope is that he will still be a director with our company, he will still be an actor with our company, and that he will still provide leadership in the areas of new play production, play prospecting, and dramaturgy and education, which are areas that have been close to his heart and close to his level of excellence throughout his history here.
So pending his decision, and everything is up in the air right now, as you said, you would expect him to or hope that he would remain on the payroll?
Yes.
Okay, very good. I want to point out that Jeff Nelson has been quoted in this morning's papers as being supportive of this move. He did mention that he was taken off guard by some of it, but he did say that Stephen is very talented. The work he did for us is exemplary, as is his leadership. He saved the Phoenix out of the ashes of Players Theater. Everything that Stephen does was a real accomplishment. And there aren't a lot of people who would disagree with that if you know the theater in this area. Stephen Anderson is certainly a stellar name out there.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And you know, one of the facets of this whole merger is, I think, a high level of respect on all parties. You know, one of the things I love about being a part of this merger is I love and respect each of the individuals and institutions involved here. And so for me, again, the excitement for me is to take these two companies, bring them together. We're going to be more stable. We're going to leverage the talents, skills, and resources of both companies to expand the educational opportunities for both, and frankly, to expand the programming on both stages.
Jeff did mention that he was a bit unprepared or caught off guard, I think is what he said, or was quoted as saying. So how long has this been in the works if he was caught off guard?
Well, the merger itself has been in the works for some time. It started out as an idea that we were just kind of in casual discussions about probably a year ago. And in May, we really, the lens of the recession brought it into focus mm-hmm. as we looked for how to find ways to sustain the arts in Columbus. And he's been involved in it from the beginning, but I think the caught-off-guard aspect of that is in the way the communication came down from the board about the way the company would end up looking. And not to dodge a bullet, but that's been a function that we've left to the board and the artistic director in terms of a hierarchy of leadership.
Well, then obviously you're in your position, then you are saying that you have full confidence in your board?
Yes,
okay.
I do.
Very good.
Matter of fact, I have full confidence in both boards.
Excellent. T.J. Gerkens is the managing director of CATCO. They are in the news today. If you check today's Columbus Dispatch, you'll see a headline, CATCO and the Phoenix Theater to join forces. We are doing an arts panel show in 2 weeks on this program, so maybe we can talk more about it then.
Love to be there.
Thank you very much, T.J. Gerkens.
Thank you very much, Christopher.
We are back with our book panel now. Let me reintroduce Bill Eichenberger, whose profound writings about books you read in the Columbus Dispatch. Cassie Rose is the NPR WOSU book critic, and she has a wonderful blog called thelongestchapter.com. Kevin Griffith is professor of English at Capital University. Kevin is floating on a recent success because he was behind the recent visit to Columbus of British author A.S. Byatt, who almost received the Man Booker Prize again. She just missed it around the week she was here, but that was quite an evening last week that you brought her here.
Yeah, it was a wonderful evening, great attendance. I was, I know you were there too, Christopher, and I was just blown away by the number of enthusiastic fans that she brings in and the people with the long line to get books signed and people carrying stacks of books. I think it was about an hour wait if you wanted to get a book signed. So that was just a thing that happens once in a decade to get someone of that stature.
Not to be a show-off, but Cassie Rose interviewed A.S. Byatt, and that interview is on our website at WOSU.org if you'd like to go there. She was quite sure. One calls her Dame Antonia, doesn't one, Cassie?
Yes, we had to figure that out before we called her. We didn't know how to address her, so we learned many things, or I learned many things on that call.
But she was warm and charming. She was a lot of fun. And her new book is The Children's Book, which is not a children's book. It weighs about 20 pounds, but it is a very, very good, if lengthy, read.
Christopher, can I ask Kevin a question?
Please.
Her books are kind of erudite and not in a pejorative way, but academic. How did she become sort of a superstar, though?
I think because she tells a good story. I think if you read her latest book, the children's book, that is erudite and it encompasses all sorts of history, sociology of the turn of the century of England. But she's a really great prose stylist, and you can get through that book at a really fast pace, surprisingly fast pace.
Yeah, but to Bill's point, though, she is mm-hmm. coming in on both sides of it. I mean, James Wood just skewered her in the London Review of Books, basically saying that she was too erudite, too into the details. There is no plot, no intrigue, no romance, and yet so there are really two camps, and there are several critics that came in on that level. And then on the opposite side, which is the one that I come in on, is that it's a sumptuous feast. Mm-hmm. And there is no plot, but you get so involved with the characters and with the detail. So you either love this book or don't love it. Uh-huh. And you have to love it because it's more than 600 pages.
Well, that goes back to something that we've talked about before. I mean, how far do you get into a lengthy book that you know you should read, like Penicillin, before you say, that's it, my life is too short, I am putting this down, I can't do it. So I read a lot of – I get grouchy because I get stuck reading a lot of books I probably aren't. I'm not enjoying. Mm-hmm. How about you, Bill? When do you put a book down?
Well, I mean, that's hard to answer because if you get committed at a certain point, you're kind of stuck with it. I mean, if you've read a certain length of time, but as I've gotten older, I've become better at setting things aside. I think the last time we talked about it, I mentioned Dorothy Parker's line about this is not a book for setting aside lightly. It's for throwing with all one's might.
So, oh, I should do that. That's right. That's good advice.
You have to make a sort of a gesture, you know?
Yes, that's right. If you're going to do it, be dramatic about it. Yes. Let's talk about some of the books, a few of you brought with me. Cassie Rose, you stopped me in the lobby and you put a book up and you said, you, Christopher Purdy, have to read this book. So what is the book in question?
The book is The Anthologist by Nicholson Baker. And the history, though, here is that on our last show, I had written this book down and slid it on a piece of paper across to Kevin and said, this is a book about, the narrator is a poet, and you might be interested in this. I don't have time to read it. Well, about a week later, I get this email from Kevin that says, this is a fabulous book. I'm finished it. I'm going to read it again, and you must make time for it. Well, considering he told me I had to read Revolutionary Road, and I loved that book, I thought, all right, here I go. And it is a terrific book, and the narrator is Paul Chowder. And he's writing an introduction to an anthology of rhyme, which he has put together. He can't bring himself to do it, so he paces and sings in his office, which is in the barn. His relationship of 8 years, the woman has left him because he is just not getting anywhere. And what is beautiful about the book is really his narration, which is so natural. You feel like you're in the room with him, and mm-hmm. you get it, because our own stresses and worryings and trying and procrastinations are very much the same. And at the same time, though, he's also teaching about poetry and iambic pentameter and why rhyme is wonderful.
The title of the book in question is The Anthologist. Nicholson Baker is the author. Let me ask Kevin, who's Nicholson Baker?
Nicholson Baker has written several books, nonfiction and fiction. He writes frequently for The New Yorker. He's a great short story writer. He's also a very experimental writer, different, and he's quite the opposite of Byatt, is that everything you read by Nicholson Baker is pared down.
Is this one as well? Because it seems...
This is a great book because you're into the mind of this character from page one and you never leave, and it's like mm-hmm. you are Paul Chowder and dealing with those struggles. Other books he's written, he's taken a lot of risk. He's... A Box of Matches was a really interesting book, narratively, because each chapter is the length of time it takes someone to write while a match is burning away. So that's a lot of these short chapters. And then Checkpoint was I didn't like Checkpoint, but Checkpoint was just all dialogue about a guy contemplating assassinating the president. That was interesting, too.
Well, wasn't one of his first books, either I can't remember, Vox or The Mezzanine, was just – mm-hmm. took place during a man's lunch break while he was riding up an escalator.
The Mezzanine.
The whole book.
The whole thing is just a man riding up an escalator and going into his head.
Sounds like he's on some very interesting chemicals and medication. I mean, that's a very interesting way someone's brain would have to work. Mm-hmm. Do you really compress something and make literature – not literature, but something that would keep your attention mm-hmm. over a short – weird time span like that.
His latest thing, too, is he's really on a soapbox. He's done a lot of writing. He's very anti-Kindle and anti-electronic publishing.
Well, he was involved in saving newspapers. We've talked about Double Fold.
Mm-hmm. The Double Fold. And that's the only book that he's won an award for. He got the National Book Critics Circle Award for that book.
Double Fold, you said, someone said, is it The Terror of Librarians or something like that?
Well, Bill said that.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he took the whole profession to task for getting rid of card catalogs, for pulping a lot of books and putting them on microfilm or and especially destroying old newspapers, which is what he went and bought. I think he bought a run of, you know, like 10 or 15 years of various newspapers that he had housed in a warehouse up in New England where he lives. And so he was objecting to them getting rid of
the newspapers.
Yes. And he was also talking about the alternative being the microfilm or the digital capturing, which inevitably leaves things out.
Hold that thought. We're going to take a break for 1 minute and come right back. We're talking about Nicholson Baker and his books Double Fold and The Anthologist, and then we'll want your calls. We want to know what you're reading. Come on back in 1 minute.
On your drive home, get local updates with the award-winning WOSU News Team.
Apparently she is here at the Congress. and he broke in and she shot him.
But Floridian Jan Avery doesn't believe crime is a problem unique to Columbus.
When you have this many people come in for an event this big, it always draws in the undesirables as well.
Hear the latest in local and national news with All Things Considered on WOSU 89.7 FM.
You're listening to All Sides Weekend on WOSU 820 NPR News. Currently 66 degrees in downtown Columbus with some sunshine peeking through those clouds. It will be a mostly cloudy afternoon with rain showers and a high of 68 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from Integrate, helping to improve business performance through brand design and marketing communications for more than 20 years. On the web at integrateinc.com or at 614-421-0004.
Welcome back to All Sides Weekend. I'm Christopher Purdy, and we are talking about books with Kevin Griffith, professor of English at Capital University. Cassie Rose's blog is thelongestchapter.com, and Bill Eichenberger, you've read about him, all about his work in the Columbus Dispatch, and they've bought stacks of books with them. We've been talking about the author Nicholson Baker and a couple of his books. Kevin, you mentioned Kindle and e-books and such. I've got to ask you, let me just give the number first. Give us a call. We'd like to hear from you, 292-8513. Tell us what you're reading. Tell us what you're curious about. Give us a critique of what's going on in your reading life. 292-8513. What is Kindle?
Well, Kindle, I think we had one on the show in the past, but I think Cassie has one. But Kindle is an electronic reading device. The Kindle is specific to Amazon.com. They produce the Kindle. And what's unique about the Kindle is that it's on a 3G network so that you can just press a button and get a book anytime, any place, and it'll be transmitted to your device. It's small. It's about the size of a small notebook. The screen is a black and white screen, but it imitates the qualities of paper, so there's not as much eye strain as reading a computer. But Nicholson Baker did a review of the latest incarnation of the Kindle, the bigger, and said that he didn't think it was worth it. He didn't think that it lended itself to a quality reading experience. He said the quality of the light in the Kindle was like that coming out of a tomb or something. And he said, it just didn't
feel
like.
Depending on who you are, you can. Yeah.
But there are many, many of these electronic readers coming out. I know. And
So you carry them around with you, and you press a button, and you have access to pretty much anything you want to read.
Well, anything that's been made available to be downloaded, isn't everything.
Well, what if you have lousy eyesight like I do? How does that work?
That's one of the supposed advantages of the Kindle, because you can do anything you want with a type font. You can make it as large as you want, smaller, correct?
Yeah.
You can have the Kindle can read the story to you.
See, I don't read Excel online. Forget it. I'm not doing all these lines and moving stuff around.
Here's the benefit of it. When I was talking to during the book signing for Dame Antonia, I was off to the side talking with her husband. He bought a Kindle so that he could read Wolf Hall. Wolf Hall, which weighs in at 600 pages. Well, he was on tour with her, and he didn't want to carry this huge book around.
Well, that's
so that's why he bought the Kindle.
Yeah. I mean, that's really, the selling point if you're traveling.
So you pay a monthly fee for access to this or what?
No, you just
pay charge
for
per product that you download.
Oh, per book. Okay. Yeah.
Newspapers, too. Wall Street Journal, New York Times, that kind of thing.
I mean, does it then stay in the system and you can reactivate it if you want to?
So yeah, you own it then, yeah.
Because Wolf Hall is a commitment. Wolf Hall is a commitment. I'm reading it now.
But they are still trying to figure out what to do about this, because there was one book, and I forget what it was. I thought it was a
1984,
yes, that people were downloading it, and then there was some sort of a problem that happened with it, and so Kindle pulled it back. So that kind of Big Brother power was disturbing, and so to me it says that the industry is still trying to figure itself out. But the other thing is that the Kindle is not the only one there. There's the Sony Reader, and the Nook is coming out from Barnes & Noble end of November. So these things are here to stay.
And Asus, the computer company Asus, I just read something yesterday. They're coming out with a cutting-edge e-reader that actually is a double fold. It actually will fold like a book, and it has its color screen. And you can also use it to do many things a computer does, too, surf the web.
I wonder what these Kindles do to the whole concept of a library. I mean, will you be able to download for free from the Columbus Metropolitan Library into your Kindle?
Not yet. I've tried that with my son to download things from the library, and that's very limited what you can do.
That's what I wondered.
And there's built-in, after a while, you have to take the library book back. So yeah. It's built in so that it, you know, the system will just reject
your
book.
Well, that was the thing, too, is that that's what, that's what they're talking about, at least I've heard in the past, is that they'll have something where it's kind of a time delay, and then after 10 days, it just disappears from your computer.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from a caller who couldn't stay with us. I think his name was Richard, but he called in wanting to know your opinion of the new James Ellroy book that was part of a trilogy. Is that ringing any bells here?
No.
It is, but I haven't read it. But a friend of mine who's read all three says it's absolutely outstanding, and that if you like the first two books in the trilogy, that this is definitely one to
James Ellroy. Okay, yeah. Richard, I hope that was helpful. Thank you very much. We have a call from Ian who wants to talk about music. There you go. A book for Halloween. Hello, Ian. Ian, are you there?
I'm sorry. You guys are cutting out. Hi. Just appreciate the program. I had just finished reading The Strain by Guillermo del Toro and Chuck Hogan, and I thought, you know, I'd really enjoyed it. And given that we're in the Halloween season, I didn't know if your guests could recommend any other good horror novels.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Some horror novels, yes.
Yes, I have a great one. I think one of the best horror novels ever written is World War Z by Max Brooks. Max Brooks is an interesting writer. He's Mel Brooks' son.
Oh, wow.
And World War Z is a lengthy novel, A.S. Byatt in length, about various points of view. It comes from various monologues from people who have survived a takeover of the world by zombies. That's what's happened. It's a zombie novel. Brooks also wrote The Zombie Survival Guide, which is like a parody of how you – of survivalists and how you – if there's a zombie attack in the area, what you should do. And
I just
like,
go to bed myself.
Well,
apparently
the first thing you do is if there's a zombie outbreak, you get an axe and you chop all your stairs apart. So you live upstairs because the zombies can't get up. Without stairs, they can't get
Who
you.
Knew? That's so, good
yeah,
to
it's,
know.
It's very important
title
knowledge.
Of the book again?
The Zombie Survival Guide and World War Z by Max Brooks. I think they're wonderful.
Well, and I'm going to have to come out here and say that because on my blog I kind of skewered the Zombie Survival Guide Recorded Attacks that is the newest book out. I think I used the word rubbish. So I'm going to – but and then someone wrote back and told me to lighten up.
So, I saw that, yes.
Yes. Well, so, you know, there you go. And I took a moment of pause and I thought, you know, well, maybe, you know, my literary snobbishness needs to, you know, take a breather here. So
we all have our guilty pleasures, you know.
Yes, yes, because also on that guide to life on that one, and of course there's a vampire survival.
Isn't it an advice manual? A werewolf advising us how you know?
No,
how
if you turn into a werewolf,
if you what do you do?
Yeah,
I
what
see.
Do you do? And my whole take on that was, you know, we've just got a glut of too much of stuff coming into the bookstores, and you know, shouldn't we really be picking up Bram Stoker's Dracula? Yeah. If you haven't read it, which yeah. I have not read, and so I did pick it up, and there was a new edition coming out, yeah. So I'm currently reading that.
What's really interesting is this glut of taking classic literature like Pride and Prejudice and just inserting horror. Have you heard about this
no,
trend?
The zombies.
Yeah, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies was a New York Times bestseller for a while, and they just inserted scenes of zombie mayhem into Pride and Prejudice, and then everybody began imitating it. It was like Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters, and it went on, and that faded out rapidly.
So
thankfully.
Jane Austen's yeah. not here to defend herself.
No.
But speaking of Jane Austen, I'm looking at Bill Eichenberger because in his big book bag that he brought in today, he has not only Moby Dick, but he has Pride and Prejudice, and he has Kierkegaard. Bill's up for light reading.
There's a picture of Dorian Gray there.
Picture of Dorian Gray. Yeah, so tell us, Bill.
Bill
has brought us some classics, I guess, in new editions.
Yeah.
This with zombies or without?
Without zombies.
Good. Okay.
Sans
yeah.
the zombies. The one series that I think is – and it's always gives you – you had said that how you had a difficult time or an impossible time getting through Moby Dick.
I did, yeah.
And I have too. But every time there's a new edition, it gives us an opportunity to think at least about tackling it again. And Penguin is doing a series of classics with new cover illustrations and the new introductions. And for instance, Moby Dick – is the cover art's by Tony Millionaire, and the foreword is by Nathaniel Philbrick, who's a big nautical maritime writer. Mm-hmm. They've done Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn with an introduction by John Seeley and notes and cover art by Lily Curray, and they did an Edith Wharton novel with Elizabeth Ammons doing the introduction and notes and the cover art by Jeffrey Brown. So kind of popular current illustrators. And
so everything old is new again. Does it matter what edition you pick up of some of these classics?
It can, if it, especially if they're in translation.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a big to-do over the translation of The Stranger several years ago, which actually was supposed to get the language back into sort of the working class language that the book had originally been written
it's
in.
Low rent, yeah.
Yeah. Because the one I had read was written by kind of an upper class British translator who, and I remember the very final line where the main character is hoping that his execution is met with howls of execration, but that would never happen if you're using working man's vernacular.
Doesn't make sense when you think about it. Yeah. We have a caller on the line. We have Joe on the line who asks, "Where do we go to get good political commentary these days?" Hello, Joe.
Yeah. Well, most of even the biographies that we're seeing out today, it seems like everybody's got an axe to grind. Either they're the greatest thing since sliced bread, of the devil incarnate, and it seems that civil discourse has disappeared from books.
Do you mean talking about books, or do you mean in the writing of the books themselves?
Well, the writing in the books themselves. I mean, one book will say Hillary Clinton's the greatest thing that's ever come across. The other one will say she's the devil incarnate. And to have reasonable and civil discourse, it seems to have disappeared from most of everything that's coming out that isn't a novel.
I'll take
my answer off air.
All right. Thank you so much, Joe. Have you noticed, panel, my guests, have you noticed, I guess in a political biography, you are probably, it's hard not to take a side, I would guess, but I think the role of the biographer is very hard because are you not supposed to take a side?
No, the biographer is supposed to be, you know, third party and cover every kind of research possible. But therein comes the criticism is whether or not they have done their work and whether or not they have taken a side. Because, you know, sometimes, like, for example, I have two biographies of Katherine Ann Porter, and one of them brings out about how she refused to acknowledge she was part of What Price Marriage, which is a book that she helped to author, and the other does include that. Well, it's maybe a minor detail, but it for collectors, it's very important, and it shows to the point of how she denied her earlier work because she had very much of a persona that she wanted about herself, and she didn't want to show that she was poor and was having to edit for money.
Are you noticing a sort of a strident CNN, Fox News tone to books now? I mean, is that what our caller may be picking up on? I've heard
some people actually complain about chain bookstores like Borders becoming that way, that they're promoting
really?
More divisive books, becoming much more in-your-face political with the way they display things, and it's kind of off-putting to people. I'll be honest. I haven't read a lot of political biography or anything because I'm so tired of politics and that whole thing. I guess if I could recommend a writer who's I think is pretty balanced in his work, it would be David Brooks. His columns and the books he's written, I think he's pretty even-keeled, moderate writer who handles things well.
Our number is 292-8513. We enjoy your comments about what you're reading or any questions for our panel, Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffiths. And we have a caller from Tess who has a comment about iPhone and Kindle. Hello, Tess.
Actually, I have a comment about the Sony e-book, which is, you know, just like the Kindle, basically, which I did buy for my husband for the exact reason of travel, that he has long overseas travel that he makes. And, you know, to be able to take a complete library of books with you is fabulous. Also, there are a lot of books that are in the public domain that through the Google Reader you can download completely for free. So because of that and having, in our case, the Sony e-book, I have downloaded all kinds of classics, some that I have reread and some that I have never read, completely for free. So that's one really positive aspect of having one. That being said, the Sony e-book, I found out to my dismay when I got it home, is not compatible with Mac.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, boy.
And here we go, too, with all of those issues.
And I'm like a complete Mac person in every way. And that was my fault for not checking that. But now I'm stuck, like, going to the library or trying to find somebody who will let me use their PC. And these days, especially, like, with my kids, more and more of them have Macs. So I don't know why Sony has that problem, but there it is. The other thing is that you can now read a whole lot of books on your iPhone. You can get Kindle for your iPhone. And I have become completely addicted to it. I like the text, it's no problem to turn the pages because you just tap it with your finger or your thumb, so you don't even, it gets, so it's automatic, you know, you're not even thinking about doing it, you just go tap, tap, tap. And I have, you know, I've read all kinds of books on, I reread all of the Dune series on my iPhone. So it's, I really love it. It's portable. I just spent 2 weeks in Europe. I didn't take any books. I just had my iPhone. So that's my comment, and I'll hang up and listen, unless you have any questions about the iPhone.
Well, we'll talk about the – go ahead, Cassie.
Well, my only question is, as I understand the European travel part of it, but here when you're at home, are you after dinner, you know, sitting down and reading for 2 hours with the iPhone, or is it good because you're –
I'm putting on my headphones while my husband watches some show I don't want to watch, and I'm listening to music on my iPhone while I read my book on my iPhone.
Oh,
listen, can't beat it. I mean, for all my whining about technology, more people are reading more with these things, so it's got to be a good thing.
Indeed.
Thank you, Tess. Our number is 292-8513. If you have questions or comments about technology that I won't understand, but you probably will, and our panel certainly will, or about the books you're reading now or books you may have heard about. Kevin, you brought Garfield, but without Garfield. What is that you've got there?
Wow, we're moving from zombies to Garfield. Zombies all my...
to technology to Garfield, yes.
This is a wonderful book that my son discovered. My son loves reading Garfield, and he gets everything, you know, all the Garfield comics. But this one is different. He pulled this off the shelf, and this is a postmodern look at Garfield. This author, Dan Walsh, took Garfield comics and removed Garfield from them. So all you have left is the other character, John, talking to no one. And it's the funniest thing I've ever seen, because when you remove Garfield, they just become these existential cries of despair. It's hard to read comics on the radio, but here's a fantastic one. You have John in the first panel saying to no one, "I'm going on an imaginary date tonight." And then the next two panels are just blank. It's like utter desolation and despair.
That's very, very profound. I just want to make a – we have to take a break in a moment, but I want to make a comment. Our news director, Mike Thompson's listening, and he's sending me all kinds of little emails. We've gone from deer blood on walls to stone tablets to scrolls to e-books. Well, you know, ain't life great? That's just wonderful. Right. Again, our number, 292-8513. We'll take a break and come back in 90 seconds. Don't go away. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen to an interview with the photographer Roy DeCarava, who died this week at the age of 89. He was born in Harlem and dedicated his 60-year career to documenting African-American life, taking pictures of the everyday as well as the iconic. Duke Ellington was one of his many subjects. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Be sure to tune into WOSU TV tonight at 9:30 for Columbus on the Record. Mike Thompson and his panel will discuss a poll showing support for the casino plan and also showing a tight race for the governor in 2010. And also they will ask the question, is a park the best use for the city center site? All that and much more on Columbus on the Record tonight at 9:30 on WOSU TV. And remember to get more from WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Podcast new and archived news stories from WOSU and NPR. Listen to an interesting story again, share it with a friend, or catch up on the news you missed. Podcast news anytime online at WOSU.org. 66 degrees in downtown Columbus under partly cloudy skies. Mostly cloudy skies today with a chance of afternoon rain, a high of 68. Rain showers are likely tonight, a low of 55. Rain showers and cooler temperatures on Saturday with a high of 58 degrees. And now back to All Sides Weekend on WOSU 820 NPR News.
We're back. I'm Christopher Purdy talking about books with Kevin Griffiths, with Cassie Rose, and with Bill Eichenberger, welcoming your calls to 292-8513. You can send us an email to allsides@wosu.org. We have a caller on the line. Sam wants to talk about a book by Laurie Moore, who I think has a local presence. Laurie Moore. Sam, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, Laurie Moore.
Yeah, it's called A Gate at the Stairs, or The Gate at the Stairs, I forget. And she... hasn't written a novel for 15 years. She's written a little bit of poetry. She's got some short stories in the New Yorker over the years. She teaches at the University of Madison, I think, in Wisconsin. But it's a fascinating, extremely well-written. And that's all I'm going to tell you about it. You have to read it.
Okay. Tell me the title again, Sam.
It's The Gate at the Stairs or A Gate.
Gate at the Stairs by Laurie Moore.
It's gotten a lot of attention, a lot of good reviews. It had a few weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. It is supposed to – I have not read it, but it's supposed to be a very, very good book.
Does she teach at Ohio State? Did she have some kind of – no. Okay. I'm thinking of somebody else. I'm thinking of Laurie Siegel maybe who was here
right.
a few
mm-hmm.
years ago. Okay. We have a caller from Pat who wants to talk about the Twilight series and poor writing is a phenomenon. I suspect that Pat and I are going to be friends here with this topic. Pat, are you there?
I am. Hello.
Hi.
I am not a literary snob at all, but I just do not get the Twilight phenomenon. I couldn't even get through half of the first book, but all these women, all my friends are obsessed with it.
My daughter is, I can tell you that.
And I am right there with you, too. I tried to read it, too, because so many women that I know are obsessed with it, and I got through the first couple chapters. I couldn't do it. It didn't
so
hook
what,
me.
Why is she – I just don't get it. I mean, her writing is so poor. You know, we can put up with a Dan Brown, but she is just awful.
Oh, Pat, I love you. That's great. Thank you much for that. Well, I mean, that's interesting because the last time there was such a phenomenon, I think, was probably Harry Potter that people mm-hmm. – but I must tell you that I loved all the Harry Potter books, and I understand completely how people love those. I have not read the Twilight books. I know in my house I have a daughter who reads them. I know her friends probably read them. All the movies are coming out, and you have to be buff and skinny and 16 to be in these movies. What's with this Twilight books? Stuff. Anybody know? None of you have read them, have you? Wouldn't admit it, would you?
Well, no. As I said, I got through the first three chapters, and I remember we were out in the lobby, and it was another show, and I was talking to Bill and Kevin and saying, I don't get it or whatever. And your responses, though, nailed it because you said that it is women who are hungry for romance, unhappy in either
in their
relationships
or
looking for something, and it feeds that. It hits that button perfectly, so it doesn't matter that it is poor writing or whatever. And so if you don't have, I guess, that need, maybe it wouldn't resonate
Should
with you.
Should we be suspicious of great I won't say literary success, but when a book really blows, it takes off, it really is a phenomenon. Do you get suspicious or do you read it and think, well, yes, this book is that good? And Harry Potter is the last thing I can think of before Twilight that really did that.
You know, Harold Bloom was an outspoken in a minority, a critic of the Harry Potter books, and he found that there were cliches on every page and just really kind of lax writing and it couldn't get beyond that to the stories that people fell in love with. Mm-hmm. And but he was saying when I had talked to him at one point that he didn't understand – he didn't know exactly how to say – to voice what his displeasure was, and he said that then Stephen King came out and said that these are great books because all these kids will graduate to reading my books. And Harold Bloom said, exactly, that's the problem.
That's the problem.
You're graduating to from mediocre writing to more mediocre writing, at least in his view. So
I wonder if H.J. Rowling's books will be taught in 20 years. They may be taught now, as far as I know. I mean, really. I mean, what do you – Kevin, you're the professor.
Well, at Capital, it's interesting both with J.K. Rowling's and with the Twilight series since I do teach – I teach creative writing and we teach fiction. And it's very hard to get students to move beyond those two modes in their fiction. They want to write fantasy. And I'm getting a lot of stories in workshop now about the mysterious – very pale boy who I'm interested in, and will he be romantically interested in me? And it's good that they exist to contrast them with what literary fiction is. You know, that kind of thing.
A friend of mine, the analogy that I used, a friend of mine worked for General Foods, and he was at one point in charge of their coffee division, and he was talking about getting people to climb the coffee ladder. You know, you start them with Maxwell or House or with Folgers, but you get them to climb up to the more expensive, higher margin stuff. Mm-hmm. And he said what they came to conclude was that folks just simply don't climb. They're either on the higher rung or they're on the lower rung. And I think with reading, it's the same thing. If you have a steady diet of nothing but the Dan Browns and the J.K. Rowlings of the world, you end up not ever challenging yourself. You don't go to great literature from there. You just continue to read similar mm-hmm. literature.
Well, but here's my concern is because that the publishing industry is run by mega companies and we have the big bookstores and they're focused on the bottom line. That is the choice that is being given in the bookstores because they need to meet the bottom line. And these are the books that will pay. If this were 20, 30 years ago and we had independent booksellers, we would have the Harry Potter and the Dan Brown, but beside it, we would also have the mid-list authors and we would have a bookseller helping you make your choices. This is sort of like the fast food industry that mm-hmm. addicted us to the cheeseburger and French fries back in the 70s. Yeah. And that's what we now go to or what for years that we did because that was the choice that kept being moved toward us.
And this is interesting when you said about Harold Bloom, who actually went into print and said Harry yeah. Potter's bad writing. I would never have the nerve to do that. Isn't that interesting? I mean, you'd have to be very brave, wouldn't you? Don't you think?
Well, I think it's because it's part of his own cottage industry.
Yeah,
he comes out then with a book called, A Thousand Poems for Exceptionally Bright Children,
right.
or something like that.
God.
You know, it's like, well, how can a parent? Well, my child's exceptionally bright.
Sure.
I'm going to get that. You know,
we're not in there.
So he's pushing the classics, and so he's at the other end. But there's
Very good point. By the way, Laurie Moore's book is called A Gate at the Stairs. We have a call from Donna. Donna wants to know everyone's honest opinion of Oprah's choices. Hello, Donna.
Yes.
Talk about Oprah's book club.
Yeah. Just your opinion of her picks.
Okay. Kevin Griffith.
She's made some very good picks, and one of her best picks ever, I thought, was Middlesex by Jeffrey Eugenides, which I think is truly one of the great novels of the past 25 years. Just a tour de force, a stylistically elegant novel in terms of issues of gender and identity, fascinating. And she also, she had the controversy with Jonathan Franzen in the corrections, but that was an incredibly challenging novel as well.
And she tells a funny story on herself about talking to Toni Morrison and saying, well, I think I like the book, but it was so difficult, and I found myself having to go back, and Toni Morrison just kind of said, well, that's called reading, dear.
Oh, dear.
Well, and she is guided by, I think, Sarah Nelson, who used to be the editor of Publishers Weekly, is now, I don't know what her title is, but she is head of the book department or whatever of Oprah's,
She's
empire.
Oprah's book procurer.
Yes.
Presumably Oprah's too busy to be, choosing or maybe mm-hmm. choosing her own books. I don't know.
But I thought it was fascinating, too, when she stopped doing the current, those authors who were alive and went back to the classics because she had to struggle with the issues of the living authors.
Right. I mean,
like Jonathan Franzen, who threw a fit, and then, mm-hmm. The Million Pieces guy who
fabricated. Didn't write his own book. Right. Yeah.
Which that was great because she drove readers to read Faulkner. I think Faulkner was one of her choices.
Yes, it was.
Anna Karenina was one of her choices mm-hmm. as well. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. We have a call from Mark who wants to talk about a favorite writer. Hello, Mark. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
I wanted to mention a writer who passed away last year, or actually this year, J.G. Ballard, mm-hmm. Famous British writer.
Getting a lot of recognition from our panel on that, yes.
Well, that's good. I'm glad. They're releasing his complete short stories in this country, and I believe there's over 100 short stories in there. And I've read the majority of them, and they're just wonderfully imaginative. And his short stories and his novels in particular have been compared to surrealist paintings. He tends to paint just dreamscapes. And he's also considered something of an oracle or a prophet in Britain. He's predicted a lot of inventions that have come about, like biofabric clothing, houses that respond to the user's needs. He was predicting all these things in the late 1950s and the early 1960s, and a lot of them have come to pass. He's probably best known for Empire of the Sun and Crash, but I've enjoyed he's got about 20 novels, and I've read, I think, 19 out of the 20.
My goodness.
Which one was set in Spain on the Costa del Sol?
I believe that was Cocaine Night.
Yeah, that was you said dreamscapes. I'm thinking nightmarescapes sometimes, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The author in question is J.G. Ballard. Is that who just passed away, a British mm-hmm. author?
Yes.
So what's your take, Kevin, your take on?
A great dystopian writer. I mean, I'm a little scared that some of his predictions have come true because he has fascinating premises for a lot of his short stories, especially one I particularly remember was that the world had become so overpopulated that everyone was put into New York City and the entire world's population. And everyone got about 3 square feet to live in. And that's where you had to be because the rest of the world had to be used for agriculture to generate enough food to feed people. It was just an incredibly claustrophobic atmosphere he created.
He's really terrific at creating that atmosphere of suffocation I still feel like for the book, The Cocaine Nights or whatever, I still feel that sense of I joked about it, the book gave me sunburn. You know, you feel like the sun is just beating down on you when you're reading it.
We have an email from Roxandra who wants to be reminded, Cassie, of the A.S. Byatt current novel, the new novel.
The children's book.
The children's book, the 600-page.
Yes, and it's the children's book. Some people mistitle it and say it's the children's hour. It's the children's book.
By A.S. Byatt.
By A.S. Byatt, and that is because the main character is the author of children's books.
And she also recommends a book that I liked very much, Netherland, by Joseph O'Neill. Any comments on that? Did anyone read that?
I haven't read it.
Yeah, that do. Read that. We'll talk about it next time I'm going to quiz you. That's a very good book, Joseph O'Neill's Netherland. We have a call from Len, who wants to talk about The Historian. Len, hello. Len?
Yes.
You're on.
Hi, John. I read The Historian recently, and I was just terribly impressed with it and with Elizabeth Kostova. I think that's who wrote it. And I wondered, in this current glut of vampire, Dracula kind of garbage writing, I think she's terribly true to history. And enlightening, and it sort of paints a path through history like a historical novel. But I thought she did a splendid job, and I wondered what you guys thought of her.
Cassie, you seem to recognize
I recognized the novel, and because it was one that I wanted to read and I just didn't get to. But it was highly popular and well-received. And
The title is The Historian.
The Historian,
Elizabeth Kosovo, was that the name of the author?
I believe so.
Len, was that her name?
That's what I think it is. Okay. I'm real bad with names.
Okay.
What was the Norrell
Thank
book,
you, yes.
too? Robert and Mrs. Norrell? Or Mr. and Mrs. Is Norrell? I'm forgetting now. But it came out at the same time as Historian and kind of had similar reviews that it was well written. And
Elizabeth Kostova, Kostova. Thank you to the ever brilliant Amy Jurevich, who brings us all this information. The Historian is the name of the book that Len recommended. We have a call from Elizabeth, who wants to talk about Laurie Moore and Jeffrey Eugenides. Hello, Laurie. Elizabeth, I beg your pardon. Laurie's not home. Elizabeth is.
Hi. I was just getting ready to call, and then Kevin brought up Middlesex, and I'm a little bit of a snob when it comes to reading, and I would say that's one of my top 5 books, and I would highly recommend it to anybody for everything he said, Kevin said, and many more things. But the other thing is, Eugenides' first novel, The Virgin Suicides, is equally as good, and it's written from a collective narrative perspective of 5 adult men who knew these Lisbon sisters, and it's funny. It's bizarre, and the last couple of paragraphs, or chapters, actually, the last chapter, is one of the most compelling that I've ever read. It's told in the voice of these men looking back. And then with Laurie Moore, she, in case somebody wants to start out on a great short story of hers, wrote just one of my favorite short stories, which is called Cowboys Are My Weakness, and it's the title story of a novel. And I think it would be great to put that story in with these Twilight readers and to say, look, start with this. You know, it's a really great older Laurie Moore short story. But I just love the show, and I'm curious to know if any of the people on your panel have read any of these other texts, especially The Virgin Suicides.
Thank
really
you, Elizabeth.
Good.
Let's get a conversation about that. Thank you for the call. Anybody read any of Eugenides' books besides Middlesex and the Virgin Suicides? Want to comment?
I did read The Virgin Suicides, but I didn't get all the way through it. It didn't resonate with me, and I don't know if I was picking it up at a time in my life where it just didn't work, because I know I recognize that it was a good book, and I just couldn't get through. In fact, I had been was reading The Galley format. I got it really early, and I never got back to it. And because of that, I didn't get into Middlesex. And it's one of those situations now where you have an author that you have missed, and you
now
know
you're behind
that,
the curve.
Now behind thank you, behind the curve on that. And so then you have to sneak it in or whatever. And this is the I have heard someone speak about Middlesex just in the way that I've heard it on the show outside of this, and it just – he won the Pulitzer for it, didn't
yes.
he?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think one thing to note about Eugenides, though, like him or not, we're talking about literary fiction versus garbage. You know, Eugenides has been around a while, and he's really only put out two novels. Mm-hmm. And that's another sign of a great writer. You know, great writing is very difficult and takes mm-hmm. a long time. You cannot put out something of the quality of Middlesex every year, mm-hmm. you know. And I think a lot of popular writers, even good popular writers like Stephen King and others, are really pressured to crank something out to stay in the loop. And you just can't do that if you're writing for art. I mean, I don't know when did A.S. Byatt write her last book? I think it was The Little Black Book of Stories, right?
It's which been was 10 years.
Yeah, it's been 10 years.
And it's also been 10 years for Laurie Moore.
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult.
We have 4 minutes left, and in that time, I want each of you to suggest one title that people should be reading or should get to, and then we'll see in our next show in a month how many people call in and say that was a great suggestion. So let me start with Kevin Griffith.
Well, I'm going to completely go off the deep end here and suggest a book of poetry.
Excellent.
Paul Chowder would be proud of me and the anthologist, but the latest book of poetry from Franz Wright, Wheeling Motel. Franz Wright won the Pulitzer Prize 2 books ago with Walking to Martha's Vineyard. This is a wonderful book of poetry, bare bones, religious poetry stripped to its essence. Just a great, great, great book, Wheeling Motel.
When you say religious poetry, is it contemplative, spiritual? Would it inspire that, or is it
about the struggle of a man to confront his faith and what is faith? I'll just read real quickly one little line from a poem which I thought was devastating. This poem is called Kyrie, and the last line is, "Lord, I had such a good time, and I don't regret anything. What happened to the prayer that goes like that?"
Give me the title one more time.
Wheeling Motel.
The author?
Franz Wright.
Okay. Cassie Rose.
I'm going to recommend American Salvage by Bonnie Jo Campbell. It is shortlisted right now for the National Book Award, and I am just partway through it. It's a collection of short stories, and I would say it's probably a combination of Raymond Carver and Donald Ray Pollock.
Wow.
It does not have the rawness of Pollock, but it's a sleeper book that has hit this award, and I thought I'm going to, you know, jump in and read it. And it is really stunning book of stories about people that are – well, one of the stories takes place is they live in a salvage yard, and it's about a young couple that is very much in love, but the woman can't handle the animals that are coming into the house. And that's a very basic description. I can't – you know, recall the lyricism that's in it. But I would recommend that people take a look at it. I understand now why the judges brought it up for that award.
Title and author one more time.
It's called American Salvage, Bonnie Jo Campbell. It's a collection of short stories.
Thank you. How about Bill Eichenberger?
I'm going to recommend Aaron Appelfeld's most recent book called Leish. Aaron Appelfeld is an Israeli writer who writes almost exclusively about the Holocaust, but without ever mentioning the Holocaust. And it's always – or generally, books like Bodenheim 1939, The Retreat, and this are books that are set right on the eve of World War II and the Holocaust. And there's this sense of impending doom, and yet none of the characters can possibly know what's coming. So, but this book, Leish, is a fable, and it's set in the late 1800s, or maybe. It seems like it is. It never really specifies. Jews dispossessed by pogroms have formed a caravan, and they're making their way slowly to Jerusalem, and it's a microcosm of the greater outside world. There are hustlers and pimps and bad guys and it's all told from the point of view of a 12 or 13 year old boy who's in this caravan, and it's absolutely moving and spectacular.
Is it new? Is it recently?
It's
published?
This year, yeah.
Okay, tell me the title again.
Leish, L-A-I-S-H.
What does that mean?
It's the boy's name.
Boy's name.
Yeah,
Leish by the author?
Aaron Appelfeld.
I'm Christopher Purdy. This has been our book program that we don't do often enough, frankly, because we have such a good time, and I hope that the people listening had fun as well. You've got some recommendations for yourself we'll follow up with. Kevin Griffith, thank you. Cassie Rose, thank you. Bill Eichenberger, thank you. I'm Christopher Purdy. My usual beat is classical music, but once in a great while, they let me out, and this is one of those times. This is listener-supported WWSU.